Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. Today I got a few subjects on tap that I want to talk to you about. Before I get into that, I want to make sure that, one, if you haven't done so already, go to BikeJames.com and sign up for my free newsletter. I'm going to send you a free mountain bike specific workout. I send out weekly training tips and just keep you posted on all the latest things that I am into when it comes to helping you ride better, not only now, but for a lifetime. The whole riding for a lifetime thing has been something that I've really been talking about lately. And so you can find out more about that at BikeJames.com. And also want to make sure that you check out PedalingInnovations.com. That's where you can learn more about the Catalyst pedal, which is the pedal that I created. It is the only pedal on the planet that's based on the actual science and movement principles behind not only the pedal stroke, but also moving with power and agility on your bike. It helps you create a balanced foot position that allows you to tap into your full movement potential on the bike. And so again, you can learn more about that at PedalingInnovations.com. So on to the podcast. I've got three things on tap. I've got some on-bike movement skills advice. I've got a bro science segment, and I've got a gear review. I'm going to talk about the Wim Hof method and the app and the course that I've been using. And so you can call that a gear review, but it's really kind of a review of the Wim Hof method itself as well. So the on-bike movement skills, this is, you know, what you would call your technical skills. I think that, you know, again, I can't change the whole vernacular of mountain biking or expect all of mountain biking to change its vernacular. So technical skills is going to be the more common term, but I'm going to start, you know, using this term of on-bike movement skills more, because I think that it's important that riders remember that that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to execute movement skills on the bike. So the, you know, somehow there gets to be a separation sometimes when we talk about technical skills and we forget about the basic movement skills that go behind the technical skills. And so by looking at your technical skills as really being on bike movement skills, so the things that you do off of the bike, you know, in the gym, if you play another sport or have another activity, you know, these are off bike movement skills, and you think about them as that, or at least you should think about them as far as like movement skills and how do you apply good basic movement principles to these specific movement skills in order to move in the most efficient and powerful way and creating the least wear and tear on the body as you're doing it. And again, like I said, for some reason, there seems to be a disconnect for a lot of people that when they throw their leg over a bike, the bike industry's done a really good job of convincing us that, well, things are quote unquote different on the bike than they are in other sports or other activities and things like that. And yes, there's definitely differences between, you know, riding and other activities, but the basic movement principles that govern movement are going to be the same things on and off the bike. And so by looking at what you're doing on the bike as movement skills that you're applying to the bike, it'll help you kind of look at them, I think, in a more constructive way than just this technical skill category. Because again, for a lot of people, technical skill tends to be, you know, do you know the proper 10 steps of cornering or the proper, you know, 5 steps of riding a switchback? A lot of it is, you know, technical skills are broken down into steps. And so it's looked at as far as like, how do you execute these steps? And if you're messing up, then well, you must not know the right steps, and you need to learn a different step or different sequence of steps or whatever that is, right? But a lot of times that's how we look at technical skills, as a memorization of these steps, rather than looking at technical skills as an application of movement principles. And yeah, there are some steps behind that, but really the application of movement principles requires more of a feel and a more fluid understanding of what you're trying to accomplish than a, you know, a step one, step two, step three type approach and memorization. And so to that effect, one of the things or the piece of advice that I had that I wanted to share had to do with cornering. And this is an epiphany that I had with my own cornering lately. And one of the important things that I've started to realize over the last year or so with cornering is the weight and pressure on your front wheel is super important. And if you think about it, like, well, what, you know, we need traction, right? Like, so what is traction? Well, traction there's a contact patch between your tire and the ground. And what you want is pressure into that contact patch. Your weight and pressure is weight used actively. Again, if you think about a really good example to think about is if you're standing on a bathroom scale, especially one of those, the old fashioned ones that where the numbers move and it's got the red line there and it eventually stops where you're at. But you can, you know, stand on that and it tells you, you know, for me, I weigh 165 pounds. And so, and then without actually jumping off of the scale, I can make myself light and then drive force, like pressure, down into the scale and make that scale move and make the weight move up. So I don't weigh anymore. I'm still 165 pounds, right? So my weight is the same. What I did is I actively used my weight to create pressure into the scale. And so pressure is related to weight. You need weight to create pressure, but pressure is ultimately what you're after. And that pressure through the contact patch into the ground is what creates friction and the traction that we're looking for. And so one of the big problems that I see with riders that I work with is that one, there's this, you know, general advice that I think that some people are starting to question this and move away from it as being such a hard and fast rule. But the idea of light hands and heavy feet has really done a disservice to the mountain biking world because it's made people afraid to put any weight on their hands. And as I just touched on, if you don't have weight on your hands, you can't apply pressure through your hands. And your hands are what are applying pressure into the front wheel. So if you don't have any weight on your hands, you're not going to be able to effectively apply pressure into the front wheel. And so you're trying to learn how to steer and move on the bike and in corner of the bike without using good front wheel pressure. And a lot of times when people slide out on a trail or their front wheel slides out, it's because they didn't have enough weight on the front end. It's not because they had too much. I've seen it many times when people go in and they have their weight too far back and the front wheel washes out on them. And their initial reaction is that, well, I had too much weight on my front end. And it's like, no, you didn't have enough weight on your front end. Like if you would have had more weight on your front end and you were able to put pressure through that front tire, it would have held traction and you wouldn't have slid out like that. And there's also a lot of like your weight being forward actually makes it, if your bike does slide out, you're in a different position and in a better position to deal with that happening than if your weight is already shifted back. So there's some things there, but at its most fundamental level, you have to have weight on your hands in order to create pressure into the front tire. And so when you're cornering your bike, that essential pressure point is your inside hand. Your inside hand, so if you're going into a left-hand corner, then the pressure on the left hand is what is going to dictate your pressure and your ultimate traction on the front wheel. And so one, if you don't have any weight on your hands, if you go into a corner and you're already down in your attack position and you've got light hands and heavy feet and you're just trying to like lean the bike over without actually using pressure through your hand to lean the bike over, then it's a different thing, right? That's not the same thing as using that inside hand pressure. And, you know, like I already pointed out, if you don't have hand pressure or weight on your hand and hand pressure, then you're not going to be able to apply pressure through your front wheel effectively. And so it's going to make it harder to corner. You have to have some weight and pressure on that inside hand in order to be able to keep some inside or some pressure on that front wheel. Now, obviously, the thing that people start to get worried about is, well, if I have pressure on that front hand, and there's a proper way to do it. If you go to my website at bikejames.com and you look at the stick windmill, that exercise there teaches your body the corkscrewing motion that you want to use in order to apply that pressure with your hand. So you're using your whole body to apply that pressure instead of just using your arm to try to push in. And so there's a proper way to do that that keeps you balanced over the bike instead of leaning too far in. But the other counterpoint to that would be your outside foot. And so if you have pressure on your outside foot, then you're going to have enough weight to counterbalance yourself to not fall in. Because, you know, one of the things that people are afraid of is you get so much weight on your inside hand that your front end washes out and you just get slammed to the ground. And we've all been there, and it's a bad thing to do. And that's led to the whole, like, you know, lean your body or your bike and not your body, which is not what you want to do. You have to lean your body to create rotational energy to steer the bike. Like, you have to use rotational energy. You can't be dead on the bike and just try to lean it without creating rotational energy. That's a way less efficient way to turn anything. You look at how you turn anything, you're going to use rotational energy. So you have to use that rotational energy in order to corner your bike anyways. But again, the advice has become lean the bike and not your body, because if you don't lean your body, then you don't run the risk of leaning too far inside, and then that'll keep you from crashing. But if you don't lean your body, you're not going to be able to keep pressure on your inside hand. And then that means you're not going to be able to steer as effectively. You're not going to be able to corner as effectively. And so that's not good either. You're basically, you know, trading never wrecking for being able to actually produce traction and corner properly. And that's not a good trade-off. You need to learn it's like anything else, right? It's Goldilocks pressure. It's something in jiu-jitsu that which I've been doing for the last few years that I've learned a lot about. Like, too little pressure is no good, right? So if my weight's too far back off the front end and I don't have enough pressure, that's no good. Too much pressure isn't good. I'm not, you know, that's where the front end can wash out and I get slammed to the ground. So what I want is that Goldilocks pressure, the just right pressure. And that's what you're looking for. And once people learn to stop being afraid of having any pressure on their hands and realize that there's a Goldilocks zone where you can use pressure very effectively and do it safely, then it opens up your riding. And cornering is one of those things. So again, the inside hand pressure is essential. And I have, since I've started to pay attention to this, and again, one of the things that I like is, one, your body does things by feel. So try and remember step one, step two, step three. Like, there's a place for that, but really your body is going to, it runs on feel. So by using inside hand pressure, that's a feel. I can feel my hand and feel whether I have good pressure there or not. And then my body will automatically, you know, there may be some things I can work on to do better, but my brain will start to figure out the problem of how do I keep good pressure on my hand in this position. And so, you know, it does take a little practice to learn how to do it. But again, like I said, once you learn how to do it, you learn how to keep that inside hand pressure, it makes it a lot easier, because that opens up, your body starts automatically doing all of the other things, especially when you start adding in the outside foot pressure. The way that your body has to move to create inside hand pressure and outside foot pressure, everything between the hand and the foot has to move the right way to do that properly. So you don't have to think about how to move all of the different parts of your body. You just have to figure out, how do I get the pressure that I need into my inside hand and ultimately also outside foot in order to wedge myself into my bike to create this rotational energy that I'm looking for. And so, you know, that's the ultimate, your ultimate goal. And, you know, yeah, again, there's a place for breaking things down. Well, you know, what do you want to be doing with the shoulders? You know, what do you want to be doing with the outside foot? You know, where do you, so you can get into the specifics and break these things down into steps. But ultimately, the way that your body learns things and uses things is by feel, and letting your brain figure out the best way to accomplish a task, and you just staying on task as far as what you're trying to get it to accomplish, instead of just letting your brain go to whatever. So anyways, that's just kind of, you know, learning, you know, movement skills 101 there. But, so you're cornering. Next time you're out cornering, pay attention to that inside hand pressure. And I'll guarantee you that when you feel like you have better inside hand pressure, that it is going, you're going to feel like you're maintaining your traction and you're tracking through the corner more effectively. And that when you feel yourself getting too far back and you're losing that hand pressure, you're going to find yourself really struggling to keep tracking properly and find yourself having to, start doing massive inputs to try to keep things going. And that's really not what, what you're looking for. And so pay attention to that and kind of see how it goes for you. And I'd be interested to get your feedback on it. So definitely, you know, let me know, james@bikejames.com, if you do go out and give this a shot and try it for a few rides and let me know what you think. And this is also another reason that having your inside foot forward ultimately helps as well, because it places your outside foot in a better position to create pressure, because your outside foot ultimately creates pressure through the back tire. And so the front tire is the most important. If your front tire gets through the corner and your back tire breaks loose a little bit, you're fine. If your front tire breaks loose, then all things don't go well. And so your front tire is the most important. That's why that inside hand pressure, making sure that you got that going, is the primary thing. But tied closely to that is the outside foot, which not only wedges you in and keeps you from leaning too far inside, but it also applies pressure to the tire or the rear tire. And so between the inside hand and the outside foot, you're creating that pressure through both ends of the bike. And having your inside foot forward puts your body in a better position to create that movement and that pressure. And so again, just from a movement principle standpoint, I'm not going to argue what the pros do or what this guy says or whatever. That's not, you know, that's a different discussion, and I don't really care about that. What I'm worried about is efficient movement principles applied on and off the bike. And based on that, you find that inside foot being forward places your body in a better position. Now, you know, your outside foot pressure is relative to how steep, I guess, and how you have to lean the bike and how hard the corner is. And so if you have an easy corner, you don't necessarily have to get that inside foot forward. And so again, like, this is why you see people that don't necessarily do this all the time, and you don't have to do it all the time, but you will find that working on getting your inside foot forward and then applying pressure through the inside hand and then ultimately also through that outside foot, that's going to really help set you up to move better and create good pressure through the tires, which is really what you need. If you don't have good pressure through the tires, then you don't have traction. And if you don't have traction, then it doesn't matter. You know, anything else really doesn't matter. So it'll really help you apply better traction. So give that a shot and let me know what you think. So on to the next subject that I have here, and that is a bro science thing. And remember, bro science is basically, I like to look at the studies and then interpret it in my own way, and for mountain bikers. And so, you know, in the gym, that's called bro science, where, you know, one guy is telling the other guy how, you know, this supplement is going to make your pecs bigger because this one study on rats said something and blah, 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 or whatever, you know. So it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but it is based on actual studies that I've looked at and seen, and then just kind of my thoughts on them and what I think you can take away from them. And this bro science looks at, I'm going to talk about one set versus multiple sets for strength training. And this is a subject that has been around for about as long as they've been studying strength training and has never really gone away, which should tell you something right there, that there's not a definitive answer, that there's multiple things going on here. And if you can better understand what's going on, then you can better apply these methods rather than just trying to shoehorn both methods into solving the same problem, right? Like, what problem does each one solve and how is it doing that? Now, how can we better apply that to what we're trying to do as mountain bikers? Now, again, if you're not familiar, one set is doing like one set of an exercise. It's often associated with one set to failure. You know, the original high intensity training before the high intensity interval training came along. But high intensity training, Mike Metzger, Arthur Jones, these guys were real famous early pioneers. Dorian Yates, who is a real famous bodybuilder, just massive human being. He was really well known for one set to failure. But you basically, it's not a true one set, right? Usually what you do is you do a few warm-up sets, and then you have one work set where you just do one set and give it everything that you absolutely have. And so that's one set training. Multiple set training is you may do a couple warm-up sets, but you're going to have multiple work sets. So you're going to have, you know, two or more sets where you're working quote unquote hard. Like, this is your, you know, you're putting in work. And so, you know, you're working above, you know, that 60 to 70% range that you would be at if you were just doing a warm-up. And so the question is which is more effective for strength training, right? Can we just do one set, oftentimes, to failure, or do we do multiple sets? Some studies show one set to failure, or, just one set of I keep saying one set to failure, and that's not necessarily tied into that. That's just a real popular way of doing it. But oftentimes you are, coming really close to that with that one set. You're putting in a really hard effort for that one set. And, you look at the studies, and some studies show that one set is just as effective as three sets. Some studies show that three sets, multiple sets is more effective. And so the jury is out as far as what is most effective. But here's the thing. When you take a step back and you ask a couple questions, I think that things become a little clearer as far as like what we can take from all of this and use for ourselves as mountain bikers. So one is, how are they measuring strength? This is really important because this is the context. What is the context of strength that they are measuring? And oftentimes, it is a movement-based test. So sometimes they will test isometric strength, but a lot of times they're going to pick something like, let's say, for example, they're testing leg strength, and they're trying to figure out, what works for building leg strength. And so they're going to pick an exercise that represents leg strength on some level. So it could be a free weight exercise like the squat or deadlift. It could be a machine exercise like the leg press or, leg extension or leg curl. But they're going to pick some sort of exercise, which usually implies some sort of movement, specific movement, to test the strength. And so then they're going to have them do the protocols. And so they'll do, one set as hard as you can with, let's just say that they're testing squat, right? So they're testing the squat, and they have them do one set, and then they have another group do multiple sets. So usually about three sets is a pretty common number that they're looking at. And what you're going to find a lot of times is that the group that does multiple sets is going to do a little bit better, but it's not significantly better than the one set. And so what you're finding is that you have two things going on. And a lot of this has really become clear to me as I got more into isometric training and started to understand how you're using tension to create movement and how you train tension and movement as separate things. And so when you're doing one set and you're putting everything you got into it, normally, usually speaking, you're going to be producing more tension in the muscle, higher levels of tension than you are when you're doing multiple sets. When you're doing multiple sets, you're going to fatigue the muscle more. And so the overall tension levels are usually going to be higher in a single set compared to multiple sets. And so what you're doing with that single set is you're teaching the body how to produce a high level of tension within that movement pattern. When you're doing multiple sets, what you're doing is you're teaching the body how to move more efficiently. It's getting more exposure to it, so it gets more reps. And your brain is going to become more efficient at whatever you do more of. And so it literally becomes, your brain becomes more efficient at recruiting the proper muscles to turn on and the other muscles to turn off, and just you move more efficiently. And so a lot of the strength gains that you see from the multiple set stuff is coming more from movement efficiency. The strength gains that you're seeing from the one set stuff is coming from high tension levels, or basically training your tension levels. And so strength, contextual strength, strength within the context of your sport or whatever you're doing, usually it's going to be specific to the movement and how you are creating tension within specific movements. And so again, like a power lifter, their specific movements that they're looking at are squat and bench and deadlift. And so for them, like the more they squat and bench and deadlift, the more efficient they're going to get at doing that. And they want to do, high tension, lower sets, because they want to build their ability to create high tension within those things. But that's their sport, right? For us as mountain bikers, the context is different. The context for us is on the bike. So, we're not necessarily looking to become more efficient movers at an exercise as much as we're looking to become more efficient at creating and using tension within the specifics of our sport. So again, those things are tied together, but they're not the same thing. And so what this means is that you want to use high tension training and you know, multiple set, you know, training for different goals, really. And on some level, this is what people kind of tend to do. They're just not necessarily doing it consciously. And you also run into a problem, and this is where, for me, isometric training has really helped, is that the one set to failure, this is the problem, right? It works. The studies show it works. If you've ever tried it, it works. It's not sustainable. You end up getting hurt. Your body can't progress in a linear line like that for a long period of time, especially if you're not taking drugs and other things to offset that. And so, and then as you get stronger, the wear and tear, the stress that you put on your body becomes greater. So like when you're, you know, squatting 100 pounds, man, okay, great. But when you're squatting 300 pounds to get the same effect, because, you know, when you first start out putting 100 pounds on the bar and doing, you know, one set of five squats was like, that was it. That's all you could do. That was one set to failure. Well, now you're able to do a set of five with 300 pounds. In order to get to the same point of getting to failure. And so this is one of the reasons people tend to start with one set style training, high intensity training, and then they eventually move away from that to multiple set training, because the multiple set training allows them to continue to work on strength within the context of the movement of their exercises without putting the super high loads. And you know that if you take something to failure, that your odds of getting hurt are higher. So doing a deadlift and doing one set to failure, especially with a lot of weight, if you've been training for a while and have decent strength levels, is a risky proposition. That's why, you know, really powerlifters don't do that stuff very often. Like if you're a professional strength athlete, you don't actually, you know, test your strength very often, because it gets to be very stressful on the body to do that. And so with multiple set training, you're able to continue to work on that. But again, we're looking at in the gym, right? Going to the deadlift. Well, I'm just becoming more efficient at moving with the deadlift. And if I get away from the single set training, well, it's also getting away from the high tension level training, which isn't necessarily optimal. And so what I've found for me is that using the isometric training, especially the ramping isometrics, which again, I've got some stuff on bikejames.com on that specific training method. But that allows me to work on the high tension. You do one set of those basically to failure. Like you're trying to take your muscles to ultimate fatigue with those exercises, which is failure. But the odds of getting hurt are really, really low, right? Because you're not moving. And I'm not saying you can't. People always like to take these challenges and prove me wrong. I've been training people long enough to know that. But my point is that you have to be really doing something super wrong to hurt yourself doing isometrics, especially like the ramping isometrics, where you start with a low tension level of just 50%, and then you ramp up to 80%, and then finally you get up to a very short period of 100%. And so if you've got your tension level set where you want them in the first two rounds, and you keep them there when you ramp up the final round, the odds of getting hurt are really, really low. But you're able to take the tension levels in your muscles to really high levels, and you're doing like a one set to failure, you know, type method when you're doing that. And so that allows you to continue to work on your strength, your tension skills within the movement patterns, but do it in a safe way. And then you pair that up with movement-based training, of which you're going to do two, three, you know, four sets, however many, whatever your, you know, program calls for. But the idea is that you use movement-based training to work on that movement efficiency side of the equation. And so that's where you would do like your swings or your deadlifts if you, you know, want to do that. Or, you know, just kind of you look at what are some movement-based exercises that will allow me to continue to work on the movement efficiency side of strength. And then, so between the isometrics with the one set to failure, and then the multiple sets with the movement-based training, you're covering both sides of that. And again, you're doing what the research says. The research says that both work. So it's not really an idea of one or the other. It's really an idea of how do we use both to maximum effectiveness. Because again, the research and the science has shown both of them to be effective, but really it's taking that next step and saying, okay, well, what is going on here? Like, why are they, you know, what is multiple set versus single set doing? And when you break that down and you understand how strength and really endurance, also movement efficiency, comes down to two things. It's your ability to create tension in the muscles within a movement pattern. All other things being equal, whoever can create higher levels of tension is going to create more strength and power. And then the other side of that is who can do it more efficiently. So the more efficiently you create a movement, then the less strength and power you actually need to create the movements. And so that's going to help your strength and power, because you're applying it more effectively and efficiently. And it's also going to help your endurance, because you're not wasting energy. And so ultimately, you need to be attacking the problem of getting stronger from both angles. And again, a lot of the traditional stuff does this. Like if you, a basic periodization scheme where you do a month of, low rep, high load training. And then you do a month of lower load, higher rep training. And usually, the sets may be similar, but a lot of times it's the total reps. Like if you get beyond just looking at sets and also look at the total reps being done. So five sets of five is only 25 reps. Whereas doing three sets of 10 is 30 reps. So, I'm doing more sets when I'm doing five sets of five, but I'm actually doing more reps when I'm doing three sets of 10. And it's ultimately reps that are building that movement efficiency. And so, again, you can see some of this stuff built in to programs already, but it's just, again, consciously understanding that's really like a lot of what science is about. It's not really about like discovering new things as much as it is like helping us understand why what we're doing is working, which allows us to apply things more effectively, and also opens up other avenues of thought to try to think, well, how else could we do this, or how else could we apply this? And so, so that's, really the ultimate goal. And so a good, way to apply that is by, applying that to your strength training there. So that is your bro science there. So again, the ultimate take home is one set and multiple sets both work for building strength. You just need to know what each is doing and how to use both effectively. And for me, using isometrics for the one set side of things, and then movement-based training for the multiple set side of things, has been the most effective for me. So, and again, the science would back up an approach like that. So, all right, on to the gear review. And so the gear review, like I said, is kind of it's a double review. One, it's a review of the Wim Hof method itself, but also a review of his app. And I signed up for the Fundamentals course and have been doing that for the last few weeks. And so just also a review of those materials as well. But if you're not familiar with Wim Hof, he is also known as the Iceman. He is really well known for his feats of endurance, especially when it comes to things involving the cold. He's also one of the main characters. I say that term. He is a character for sure, if you're familiar with him and seen him and heard him before. And I mean that in the best way possible. But he is one of the main drivers behind the resurgence of cold training. So cold showers and cold baths and all of these things that have been gaining in popularity over the last few years. Wim was one of the driving forces behind helping to repopularize those things and get people on board, or really back on board, as he's found, because these are things that people used to do, but we've gotten away from, and to our detriment in some cases, according to him, and also some of the science that he's done. So, which there's like I said, you can find out about him. Wimhoff is how you spell his name. And he's got a book, The Iceman Cometh, I think is the name of it. There's a really good book by a guy named Scott Carney called Whatever Doesn't Kill Us, that does a really good job of breaking down what Wim is about and his method and kind of how he came to it. And a really good read if you're interested in learning more about that. But the Wim Hof method itself consists of three things. The first is breathing, and it's using specific breathing patterns to elicit specific responses in the body. And a lot of these responses are things that tie into the autonomic or what, you know, the unconscious nervous system. And so are things that previously science has said we could not control. We can't consciously control these things. And Wim, through the specific breathing methods, and like I said, it's what makes him really interesting is that he's not just one of these woo-woo guys who's like, oh, do your breathing and tap into your chi and all of these things. It's he has science to back it up. He's had studies done on him, and he's trained people. Probably most well-known was one where they injected them with an E. coli bacteria that would it doesn't make you sick, but it induces the symptoms of making you sick. So it's kind of an ethical way to test people's immune systems. And so they had a control group, and they had Wim and a group of people that he had trained using his breathing methods. And it was the control group had significantly greater symptoms and problems with the bacteria that was injected into them compared to Wim and his group. And it was concluded that they were actually able to manipulate their immune response to the invading bacteria. And so again, this is something that, you know, up until that point was considered impossible. Like you're told, like you can't control your immune system on any level. It's just an automatic thing that does its thing. And so Wim has, through studies, shown that you can control things like inflammatory markers. You can control things like your body's pH and make it less acidic. You know, you can control these things through specific breathing methods. And as part of that, then in using these breathing methods, cold training and cold exposure is also part of the Wim Hof method. And again, this is one of these things when you dig into, you see that there is a long history of using cold exposure and cold training that our modern culture has gotten away from. And so Wim, again, there's science to back up this stuff, but he looks at it as vascular fitness, that you being able to control your vascular system by exposing it to heat and cold and using your breathing to control your response to these things. He's shown that the through training your body through cold exposure and things, that you can control these things, and it does improve your vascular fitness. There's all sorts of interesting research on cold training in general, and cold shock proteins and brown fat, and all sorts of things are tied into cold exposure and cold training. And so that makes up the second part of it. And then the third part is the mental side. And it's interesting, like if you're going to do the breathing and you're going to do the cold training, you're not going to get very far with it if you're not focused and working on the mental side of it as well. And so it is, it's definitely it's an essential part of it that just comes along, right? Like there's not necessarily a specific section where you're working on the mental side, but the mental training is coming from the breath work and the cold exposure, if that makes sense. So those three things there, it's the breath work, the cold exposure, and the mental aspect, the mental training that you're doing through those things that comprise the Wim Hof method. And like I said, it's been pretty impressive what he's personally been able to do, what he's been able to do in university settings, both with himself and with people that he's trained, and then also just the anecdotal feedback from people. And so personally, I've been familiar with Wim. I'd actually done the cold shower thing for a while. Didn't do it because I just didn't feel like I was getting like that big of a benefit, and I was really just gritting my teeth through it, right? It was still cold. I never really got used to the cold shower. And so I've done meditation, I've done some breathing and breath work. So, I didn't do the specific Wim Hof's breathing because I thought I knew what was going on. And so, it was one of these things that I was aware of. I had peripherally dabbled in, but I hadn't just jumped in and said, all right, I'm just going to do the Wim Hof method and commit to it and see what happens. And then a buddy of mine that I talk to on a regular basis, he's in the fitness field as well. And he's one of these guys. He's even less prone to hype than I am, right? Like, so when he gets excited about something, then I get interested. And so he decided that he was going to do the Wim Hof course. And so he started doing it. And he started giving me some feedback. And so one of the things that you do, like the basic Wim Hof breathing method, is you're doing 30 strong inhales, blowing yourself up like a balloon, and then letting go. And so it's not an exhale. You're not pushing it all out. You just let go. And so then you breathe in, and you let go. And you breathe in, and you let go. And what you're doing is you're building up an excess of oxygen. You're taking in more oxygen than you're breathing out. And so you're charging your body with oxygen. Again, there's a lot of interesting things going on at this point. You can definitely feel a difference in your physical and mental state as you're doing this and you're charging. And then after you do 30 to 40 of these breaths, you let go. So you're exhaling, you're not pushing it all out. It's just, you let go and then you stop. And then you just do a breath hold on that exhale. And as the breath hold's going on, again, that's when all the magic's working. And, as Wim puts it, you're being the alchemist. You are changing your body's chemistry. And as this is going on. And so the breath holds are an really cool experience. But my buddy started sending me feedback. And so he was getting his breath holds up to like 3 minutes, 4 minutes. And again, if you've ever tried to hold your breath for any period of time, like holding it for a minute's a long time. So when he starts telling me that he's holding his breath on an exhale for 3+ minutes, and I'm like, well, okay, there's something interesting going on here. And he started telling me about how the cold showers weren't the same. Like they weren't not cold, but they just weren't uncomfortable, and that you actually started to look forward to them. So I realized, man, I got to do the whole Wim Hof method. I got to give this thing a fair shake. And so I downloaded his free app, which at the time of this podcast, you can still download for free. And there's a lot of great info there. He's got a free mini course that explains the three, pillars of the course or the system. And then he's got the bubble breathing is what it's called. But a bubble breathing thing where he actually will, lead you through it, have inhale, exhale, and then it's really cool. And then they time your holds, and so you can kind of see how you're doing. But all of it's free, right? So you can start, and cold showers are free, right? You got a shower. It's just up to you whether you do follow his advice and start doing some cold showers at the end of your warm showers where he recommends you start. But so you can actually start trying the Wim Hof method for free. And that's what I did. So I got it, and I started doing the bubble breathing part of the app, and I started, and that's what I started with. I didn't even do the cold showers, and at first, because I hate the cold. I'm not gonna lie; it's not my favorite element in the world. And so the idea of I quit doing the cold showers because it was just not comfortable. And so the idea of doing them again was not high on my priority list. And so I started with the breathing. And man, the very first time I did it, you could tell there's something going on here. There's definitely a different state that you're physically and mentally that you are creating, through the changing of the chemistry through the breathing. And I don't remember if I got over 2 minutes my first day I did, but I got like really close. I remember the first time I'm sitting there and he counts off and he's like 1 minute, and it's like, whoa, that's crazy. Like, I don't even feel the need to breathe. And so it was a very eye-opening experience for me doing the bubble breathing for the first time. And so I've continued with it. I've actually gotten my holds over 3 minutes a few times. He tells you don't make it a contest, but it's really hard when you go up and you're about to tap the app to say, okay, I'm done with my breath hold, and you see it says 256, and you're like, I can do this for 4 more seconds. But anyways, you don't want to do that too much, I guess. Yeah, don't turn it into a contest. But my point is that I've been doing it, continue to progress with it. But as part of that, I decided, all right, I am going to do the fundamentals course. And so it's a 10-week course that you sign up for, and it consists of the, you know, there's a 45-minute to an hour session with Wim where he's talking about some stuff, and then he's got a yoga teacher that comes in and leads you through some stretches, and then he leads you through the breathing exercises. And so it's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool way to learn about the system, and having him lead you through it is definitely, I think, a good way to do it, to get a feel for the system. He has homework for you each week that to do. And then you've got some stretches, and then also like a guided breathing. So each week there's a workbook that comes with it, and each week your homework changes. And so it's covered in the workbook, but your breathing homework, there is a section, it's in the app that opens up, the section opens up when you buy the fundamentals course, and you can access it through the course online as well. But so Wim, there's a part where he leads you through your breathing homework for the week. So each week, four parts unlock. So my wife and I have been doing it, and been doing it pretty religiously. And as part of that, the cold exposures become part of it. And so, and that is, again, been eye-opening, how the breathing and really the vascular control, your ability to kind of shut off the blood flow into your limbs and keep the blood in the core and keep you the vital parts warm, it changes the experience of the cold exposure and the cold shower. And so, you know, personally, I'm up to, like, we were supposed to be doing 30 seconds of cold, and then you could do as warm as you want. Up to this point, you were doing as warm as you want, and then at the end, you started with like 30 seconds, and then we ended up building up to 2 minutes. And really, once you kind of get the hang of it, like 2 minutes plus is not that hard. And so I was doing the 2 minutes plus, and then we were supposed to do 30 seconds hot or 30 seconds cold, you know, take your warm shower as long as you want, and then finish off with 2 minutes cold. And the last few days, like, I have not turned the water to the hot. Like, once you get, you know, again, it's Colorado, the middle of summer, it's, you know, the water's not Arctic cold. Okay. So, but it's definitely not warm. But once you get the breathing going and you just kind of get your mind in the right place and you have your core warm through the vascular control that you have, it is a much better experience. It's not an unpleasant experience. And so, like I said, I haven't even reached for the warm. I've just left it cold and just started taking just straight up cold showers over the last few days. And so personally, my experience with it has been very good. My wife has had some good experiences, not quite the same. You know, the cold showers aren't quite as uncomfortable for her yet. With the breathing, she hasn't had the breath holds quite go as long, and you know, not quite able, had the deep experiences, I guess, if you want to call that you can have. Sometimes, you know, she has had a few, but the point is that, yes, people's experience is going to vary. And I, you know, definitely think that, you know, I may be experiencing, you know, better results earlier on than some people who haven't done much breath work. Like, that's one of the things, like I mentioned earlier, you know, I have been doing breath work, you know, through meditation for several years, very consistently. And so this isn't my first rodeo when it comes to breath work and how do I breathe. And so for someone who's never done any breath work at all, it may take a few weeks until it really starts to click. Like, you know, actually, like, we're in week four now, and she's actually mentioned, like, this is her best week so far. She really feels like she's starting to get, like, way more out of the breathing and stuff like that. So, you know, you just have to stick with it to kind of get those things dialed in. But, you know, personally, I feel that, you know, just beyond the health benefits, and again, if you're looking at this from a writing for a lifetime standpoint, and you look into the science behind what is happening with your body when you are doing the breathing and when you're doing the cold exposure, all of this stuff is going to help you perform and just live at a higher level for longer, just reducing inflammation, improving the immune system, alkalinizing the body. All of these things just play a huge role in aging and how you're going to age, and whether it's going to be a slow, graceful process or whether it's going to be an abrupt halt, and things are going to get ugly quickly. And that's what you don't want, right? Like, you don't want to get to the point where you can't ride anymore because things hurt so badly, or you're just, you know, your performance level is so reduced that it's just not fun anymore. Like, that's not what we want to get to. That's where the whole riding for a lifetime thing comes in, is what can we do to help us maximize our performance, not only now, but for a lifetime. So from that perspective, just the Wim Hof method by itself, I think, has a lot of value for us as riders. But even from a performance standpoint, I feel that it's going to help, because one, you know, breathing is such an important aspect of your performance. And it's one of these things that we take for granted. And the only time that you're thinking about your breathing is when you can't catch your breath on a climb, right? And thinking like, damn, I need to do more cardio. So, but breathing is one of these interesting things, because you're, most of the time it's driven by that autonomic, that unconscious nervous system, but you can consciously take control of your breathing. So it's kind of this crossover between the conscious and the unconscious. And so that is how, you know, you can actually use your breathing to help access and train the unconscious side of things. And so by using breath work, you know, one, you allow yourself the opportunity to do that, but you're also, you know, your lungs are, you know, the way that they're set up, like the more they expand, the more surface area that is opened up to oxygen to both get in and for waste products to get out. So your ability to inhale as deeply as possible is vital to your lung volume. And so if you're just doing cardio, that's not really training your breath. You know, training your breath is doing nothing and training and just working on your breathing. And then when you're doing your cardio training, you're applying your breathing to your movement. And so again, it's kind of like isometrics work on the tension, and then the movement training works on the application of that tension to the movement. That's kind of the same thing with breath work, is where breath work works on your breathing itself, your ability to maximally inflate your lungs, your ability to do that efficiently. And then when you are doing your cardio training, then you're applying those things. You're teaching your body how to apply those things to the specific movements that you want to fuel through those good breathing patterns. And so the breath work is, it's just so important for you as a rider. If you're not doing any sort of breath work, honestly, you're missing the boat. I mean, the breath work, breathing is the foundation of everything. If you're not breathing, you're not going to be able to perform. And if your breathing sucks, it's going to inhibit your performance. And so if you're just worried about your higher level performance stuff and not worried about your breathing, you're just spinning your wheels. It's like the whole, you're trying to drive with your parking brake on kind of thing. And so you need to be worried about your breathing. And again, this is one of the reasons I have been so adamant about people that I work with and in my training programs. You see, if there's some sort of cardio, especially like on bike cardio, there's a note that says, like, you have to watch your breathing and your posture. You cannot compromise those things in order to try to go harder, right? Okay. So training your breathing is the most important thing you can do for your cardio training. And doing that both on and off the bike. And so having some sort of breath work that allows you to train that is going to help you immensely in so many areas on your bike and with your training and things like that. And then also the breath holds themselves, the way that your body is set up, it monitors CO2 levels to tell it how much oxygen is in the blood. It's a negative feedback loop is what it's called. And so like a lot of things though, that governor in your brain that tells it like, hey, this level triggers a panic response if we don't have enough oxygen, that is trainable. And so by using breath holds, you're able to change your body's relationship with CO2, change your brain's relationship with CO2. And so you're able to tolerate higher levels of CO2 before your brain starts to get that kind of panicky out of breath feeling. And like that's the worst. Like you and that's not a matter of like being like tough or cardio training. That is a physiological response to the metabolic environment. And so, you know, yes, through training, you can try to like control those CO2 levels better, but by changing how your body looks at those CO2 levels and allows you to have a little higher CO2 buildup before it starts to think that it's running out of oxygen, that's another way to allow you to push yourself harder and longer on the trail and do it more efficiently. And so that CO2, your relationship and how your body and your brain monitor CO2 is, again, one of these underappreciated parts of cardio training. But again, I think that the Wim Hof method, through having the breath holds incorporated with the breathing, helps train. So, and again, like I said, the cold has a lot of stuff going on, but those two specific things I feel have a very direct benefit for us as mountain bikers over and above just the overall health and recovery benefits that you're going to get from it. So as you can tell, I'm a fan. I feel like I'm going to be doing the Wim Hof method stuff for the foreseeable future. I can definitely tell the difference in doing it, and I don't really see a reason why I would want to go back to feeling the way that I did before, which again wasn't bad, but like a lot of things, you know, you don't realize that things could be better until you try something that makes them better. And it doesn't mean that you were an idiot and things sucked before. It just means that, hey, I found a way to make things a little bit better. So yeah, there's always a little kicking yourself in the pants for wishing you'd done it sooner. But I always feel that, you know, I'm going to do things when I'm ready for them. So, you know, same thing with you. You know, if this is something that you get into and you like, or, you know, whatever it is, right? It could be this or anything really that you realize like, oh, there was a better way to do this, or something that I was missing out on that I knew about and I just wasn't taking seriously. And, you know, if I had been taking it seriously, I could have had all these benefits. You know, don't worry about that, right? Like, there'll be those thoughts, but just have faith that the universe puts things in your path at the appropriate time. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at this. And hopefully, and you know, me sharing this experience will do that for some of you guys as well. So, but again, if you do decide to check this out and you download the Wim Hof app, or check out one of his courses, let me know your experience. I'd be interested to hear what your experience is, or if you've done this stuff before. Again, love to hear, you know, just some experience from other riders with this. But for myself, something that I'm going to be using and working to incorporate more into riders that I'm working with and my training programs and stuff, because I do think that it has benefit for us. So that's it. That's going to do it for this podcast. Hopefully you guys have gotten some good info out of it. And I know I enjoyed doing it. Putting these things together always helps me out, because explaining it to other people forces me to learn it better. And so doing them is always fun and helps me get a better understanding of things as well. So I appreciate you checking this out. Remember again, bikejames.com. You can find all sorts of free stuff there to help you ride better. Skills training stuff, strength training stuff, mobility, cardio. I got a ton of free workouts you can sign up for, along with my regular newsletter. I send out, you know, at least 2 or 3 emails a week with training tips and things that help you both on and off the bike. So make sure you're making use of that resource. And then also pedalinginnovations.com, like I said before, the home of the Catalyst pedal, the only pedal that's based on actual science and movement principles, allowing you to move better on the bike, which is going to, you know, help you perform better. And it's also going to decrease wear and tear. Like, that's one of the big pieces of feedback that we get from riders, is how it helps them just not hurt. And so people that have had a plantar fasciitis and Achilles tendon issues or knee issues or lower back issues, and they've tried all the other stuff, man, bike fits and all the other things that the cycling industry tells you to do, and are still in pain. And then they switch to the Catalyst pedals, and within a ride or two, the pain's gone, right? Not like a month or more. It's like, no, it's gone. Like, within a ride or two, it's gone. Because once you allow your body to move properly and move more efficiently, it's going to not only perform better, but it's going to feel better. And you're going to be putting way less wear and tear on your body through just the unnatural way that it has to produce force and pressure into the pedals through clipless pedals or just normal flat pedals. So anyways, if you have any sort of like pain or issues in those areas, you know, while you're riding or gets triggered from riding, then make sure you check out the Catalyst pedals because they can definitely help you out with that. I mean, as far as I know, they're the only pedals that are, you know, we have medical professionals, physical therapists, doctors that recommend our pedal to their patients for that specific purpose. And so, but anyways, if you're in pain, pain sucks. So check out the Catalyst pedal because hopefully the Catalyst pedal can help you have less pain, which will help you have more fun, which is really at the end of the day is what it's all about. So yeah, once again, it's been James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems. Appreciate you guys checking in this podcast out, and I will talk to everybody next time.